This is episode 24 of Trash Talking with Eco Warrior Season 2 featuring Katie Marcini of Replate.
You're tuning in to Trash Talking with Eco Warriors, where women share inspiring stories about their careers in green business, sustainability, and conservation. Here's your host and founder of Trashy Beauty, Barbara Lee.
How often have you been at an office party or an event where there was a ton of food left at the end? I think we've all seen it, and we've probably all been guilty of letting some of that leftover food end up in the trash. If you're an avid listener of this podcast, you'll know that rescuing food is not a new concept and that we covered it in a past episode with Rescuing Leftover Cuisine. Replate is a bit different though, and I thought that it was worth covering for a few reasons. One, they cover marketplaces across the U.S., including San Francisco's Bay Area, Austin, Boston, and Chicago. So for those of you who don't live in New York City, you still have options of a company to use for your food rescuing. Two, Replate has done an amazing job of utilizing the tech community for their operations and partners with Project Dash, DoorDash's philanthropic arm, to get their foot in the door, pun intended, of new markets. And if you don't know, I am a techie by day, so the use of a resource that already exists makes me so extra happy. So far, Replate has rescued 2 million pounds of food since they began operations in 2016 in the Bay Area. If you consider that Americans eat on average 3 to 5 pounds of food each day, that's a lot of meals, about 1.67 million meals in fact. Katie does an amazing job of explaining Replate's business model and why it all matters. Let's get trash talking.
Hey, Katie, welcome to Trash Talking.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. If you would like to explain who you are and what it is that you do.
So I'm Katie Marcini, and I am the COO at Replate. We are a nonprofit food rescue organization. So we pick up surplus food, mostly from catered events, and we bring it directly to nonprofits in the area that are serving communities experiencing food insecurity. So we work on a hubless model. So we're not housing any of the food anywhere. We're just picking it up and bringing it directly to a nonprofit that's going to redistribute that food.
Super cool. Yeah. And I've heard of your company because we actually, here in my office.
Oh, love hearing that.
Yeah, we get catered lunch, you know, every day of the week, and we get breakfasts 3 days a week, and there are often leftovers, and I'm so appreciative of the fact that we do not let it go to the trash. So if you want to kind of like explain a little bit more about like what the service entails and how people can vote for their own office.
Yeah, definitely. So we have a website where donors and recipients can sign up. So on the donor end, what happens is you go to the website, you put in the information for your business, location, building instructions, and then you can schedule a pickup, either a one-time pickup or a recurring pickup for businesses that have catering on a regular cadence. And then we send a trained food rescuer who is paid to come pick up the food and bring it directly to one of our nonprofit recipients. What's a little bit different about our services is that we work on a fee-for-service model. There's a lot of nonprofit organizations throughout the United States. Most of them are volunteer-run, which can pose issues, particularly if you're, you know, working off spreadsheets and you have volunteers with very limited times where they can work. It makes it really hard to do food recovery on an on-demand basis. And because we have paid food rescuers, we're able to have people kind of standing by, ready to go to do pickups. So somebody can schedule, say it's 1 p.m. and they recognize that they're going to have a lot of food left over. They can then schedule a pickup and we can get someone there as soon as 2 p.m.
Wow, that's amazing. And you guys are in a few different cities now. It's not just New York City or where you're based.
Yeah, definitely. Our largest market where we started was the San Francisco Bay Area. So that kind of encompasses San Francisco, San Jose, Redwood City, and then, you know, the East Bay. We're also in New York, which is our second largest market, and then Los Angeles, Boston, Austin, and Chicago. And then we have some emerging markets in other places. The way that we kind of enter those emerging markets is with a partnership with Project Dash, which is kind of the philanthropic arm of DoorDash. And so they help us fulfill pickups in those emerging markets where we haven't yet hired a food rescuer.
Oh, wow. That's super cool. Yeah. I didn't even realize that existed.
Yeah, it's really awesome. It's definitely helped us grow much faster than I think we would have been able to otherwise. Because when you have people that want their food recovered, you want to be able to accomplish it. And then it kind of seems like once you get one pickup in an area, for example, Dallas right now, we're suddenly seeing more requests. And then once we get two regular recurring food donors, we're able to go, okay, time to get a food rescuer and move away from using DoorDash in this area to our own food rescuer. So it helps us kind of ease into new markets.
Super cool. Yeah. And I guess the more important thing to kind of discuss a little bit is, for anyone who hasn't already heard, like, why food waste is so impactful for the environment.
Yeah, definitely. So in the United States, we waste, I mean, it's estimated that we waste about 40% of our food. And I think the thing that people don't understand is the amount of emissions that food that they waste puts off, particularly in areas where that food isn't being composted. So there's a food waste hierarchy that I'm sure some of the listeners of this podcast are aware of. At the top is source reduction, which is not creating any food surplus at all. And then after that is feeding people, and then feeding animals, and then compost, and then landfill. That food, once it's wasted, puts carbon dioxide into the air. It also wastes water that was put into the making of that food, plus all the emissions that were emitted in the transportation of that food. So all throughout the food chain, resources are being wasted. And then on top of that, emissions are being produced by that food once it goes to landfill or compost.
Yeah, we actually have another food rescue organization here in New York City that I work fairly closely with called...
Yeah, Rescuing Leftover Cuisine.
Yes, yeah.
Yes, they're great.
Yeah, and I've done a food rescue with them, which was super interesting for me to be able to see firsthand. Like, really simple in New York City, where logistically you're kind of just like hopping on and off of a subway, or even just like walking 10 blocks, and you can get from Chelsea area, where there's plenty of wasted food and lots of restaurants that have excess food, to a homeless shelter that like you don't even know is there. But because of the density, it makes it quite easy.
Definitely. New York City is probably one of our easiest markets to get food transported to.
Which is all the more reason why anyone listening who is in New York City, where there is some food waste in their office, they should definitely get on board.
Yeah, definitely. Also, this is like a little thing that I'm trying to like bring into our vocabulary, both at work and then with other people, is saying surplus food instead of food waste. Darby Hoover at the NRDC made a really big point at a waste conference recently, talking about how we've got to kind of change the way that we talk about it, because when we say food waste, it's really easy to waste it. But when we say surplus, suddenly we kind of transition the way that we think about it, and suddenly it seems like it's something that we should be doing something with versus something we should be throwing in the trash.
Oh, that's awesome. I love that.
Yeah, something I've been working on in my own vocabulary recently to make sure, because when you start thinking of it as surplus, it kind of changes the way that you look at the stuff, you know, that's in your CRISPR drawer that's about to turn, or when you have stuff that's like, oh, I might not eat this. And it's like, well, if you think about it as excess versus weight, just kind of shifts things.
Yeah, for sure. That's super cool. So we've covered why this is like environmentally impactful. Obviously, this is very socially impactful too, because it isn't about there not being enough food. It's about where the food is being distributed. Why is this super important to you? Like, why is this what you're doing with your life?
Definitely. Great question. Replay is so important to me because I grew up in Central Valley. And so in Central Valley, there's a lot of farming. So there's a lot of food, but then there's a lot of food insecurity. Both schools that I went to growing up, my elementary school and my high school, were at such a high free and reduced lunch rate. They were both, I think, at 80% to 90%. If we think about that as kind of correlating to food insecurity, I mean, most of the people that I went to school with were food insecure. Recovery is really important because it's helping us reduce food waste, which hurts the environment, and it's helping us feed people. But I think the ultimate goals would be source reduction, so we're not having that surplus to begin with, and ending poverty so people had a choice in the resources to purchase the food that they wanted. But in the meantime, I think food recovery is really important to me because the nonprofits that we work with, many of them, their main job is not necessarily feeding people. They're working in harm reduction or in job skills training. And in order for them to focus on their core programming, they need resources. Like, this food is providing a resource for them that's freeing up other resources. So instead of having to pay for groceries to make meals to serve the people that they work with, they're able to save money on labor and groceries and time because we're bringing them these meals. And then they can focus that energy and that time and that labor towards their core programming. And I think that that's kind of one of the more interesting benefits that we offer that I don't think is thought about as often, is that those recipient organizations, feeding people is just kind of one part of the many things that they do. And I think anytime we can give those nonprofits some resources back and help them is a positive.
Yeah. And how do you explain to people, because I've heard this pushback as well, and I know that both yourselves and Rescuing Leftover Cuisine do charge for pickups. How do you kind of communicate to people why it's important for these pickups to come at a cost?
The reason why we charge for our services is pretty simple. One, we don't want to incentivize people continuing to create this food surplus. We want them to have a behavioral change. One way to do that is to ensure that they value that service. Two is that people want a reliable and on-demand service from us. They want a food rescuer that's friendly and engaging and that they can trust. And in order to do these things and to be reliable, it's kind of imperative for us to have paid employees and not to be volunteer run, particularly for that on-demand piece. And so in order to do that, we have a fee-for-service model. I think it's also becoming more popular amongst nonprofits because relying on grants is really difficult and challenging. And right now we rely on grants for 50% of our revenue and the other 50% is earned. And we're trying to get to a point where we scale and we are self-sustaining. And I think ultimate goal for us, and I think it would be nice if more nonprofits were able to move in that direction just because labor is valuable and I don't think that it should be unpaid.
Yeah. And so that's interesting to learn about like how you guys are currently funding the business, because obviously I think people don't think about this. I know I understand it and I think that you should pay for it, but I've definitely seen instances where they'll say like, oh, the amount of food that is left over is not significant enough for us to spend the $20 to call the service. So some food does end up getting wasted, which is unfortunate.
Yeah, definitely. And I think it can be challenging to figure out what amount of food is valuable enough to a person to end up donating. But I think that's why, you know, those free options do exist. But I also think that it's hopefully getting to a point where that behavioral change happens enough where when there are those smaller amounts of food, being able to like figure out who can take it home because it is a smaller amount, and like understanding, okay, maybe next time we'll reduce our ordering because we don't necessarily want to pay for this service and we don't necessarily want it, the food to go to waste. And I think that behavioral change part of getting people to get to the point, particularly with events and in offices, where they see running out of food as a positive rather than a negative. Because I think oftentimes when it comes to event planning or any type of thing that's going to have food served, everyone's always so concerned about running out of food until the moment the food is served, and then suddenly they're concerned about the amount of surplus food that they're going to have left over at the end. And I think getting people to kind of think about that earlier on is important.
Oh, yeah. No, I talk about this all the time, actually.
Oh, I know. It's so difficult. And, you know, I was talking to someone the other day for her office. It was an office manager. They had 80 people, and she orders for 60 people, and they still have surplus every time. And it's just like, oh, caterers and office managers, we all got to get on the same page.
Yeah, that's actually a really good point, is that it is somewhat variable because, you know, kind of up to this random restaurant that's being called for the service to determine what they think is appropriate for 30 people. And it could be drastically different between,
definitely,
you know, one restaurant owner versus another.
Yeah, and also, you know, another thing is, you know, if they run out of food, they don't want to get a call from the customer like, oh, you know, we paid for this much food and we ended up running out. And, like, you know,
yeah,
can be very challenging for caterers.
Yeah, but I think you're right. It is like a norm kind of situation.
Yeah, definitely.
Can you share some details around, like, the impact measurement of the work that you're doing? Like, how much food is actually being rescued?
Yeah, definitely. So right now we have recovered 2 million pounds of food since we started in 2016. So when we started, we were barely doing, you know, any pickups, and now we're to the point where we're doing 90 pickups a day across all markets. So that's about 1.67 million meals, which is pretty cool. I think we hope to have better metrics in the future of how many people we're serving, but because we don't do the distributing of the food, we have less good data about that right now. But we've also saved 547 million gallons of water and diverted 27 million pounds of CO2 from the atmosphere.
Wow, that's super cool. Let's shift the conversation a little bit. So you've been doing this work, you know, for a little bit now, and it's obviously super important to you. Why does the environment matter to you? Like, why do you care about, like, the environmental impact of this project?
Yeah, definitely. I think, you know, I'm a human, and I want to see this world going on and in a better form than it is currently. And I think particularly as a person, I want children, and I feel like you want to kind of contribute to the world population. You need to be making sure that it's going to, that the environment is a safer place And I think just being a global citizen and caring about how other people were affected by your actions, I think it's really easy, particularly in American culture. We have a really consumerist, capitalist culture. I think it's really easy to forget about the impact that our day-to-day choices have on other people. And I think, obviously, large corporations have a lot to do with those. The amount of plastic polluted, I'm making an impact on a daily basis because that some of the other decisions in life have some environment, whether it's and trying to be, you know, a conscientious inhabitor of this planet.
Yeah. And so what have been some of the biggest challenges that you faced, either personally through working on this project or in, you know, your personal life and trying to live a life that is a little bit more conscientious and sustainable?
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, it's politeness is kind of one of the biggest struggles, particularly when it comes to things like single-use plastic, like being able to assert yourself. For example, like my sister and I went for ice cream the other day and I rarely finished cone, and so then there's food waste and it's like, okay, so then you need a spoon, and like asking to use one of the metal sample spoons to eat my ice cream instead of the plastic spoon that they were going to give me to go. I think just having like question where it's like, oh, like I don't want to be kind of a pain in the butt or like persnickety, but this is something that matters to me, and to kind of assert, particularly if you're not like, I haven't gotten to the point yet where I'm carrying around reusables with me. I have a coworker, Jen, who is very good at that, and who's like inspired. Look at our office. We don't use paper towels. We only have cloth, and then everyone has their own napkin. And so it's just like things like that, like those small changes. But I think that it's harder, you know, when you're in a group of people that is conscious, it's a lot easier to make those decisions. But once you kind of get out into the real world, sometimes asserting yourself is a little more uncomfortable. And I think, you know, changing those cultural norms is uncomfortable.
And so what about some things that have been, I guess, more challenging within, like, the business? Because it sounds like you guys had, like, a really pretty big leap there from 2016 to 2 million food is, you know, nothing to blink at.
I think that the biggest challenge for us is still getting people to understand that food donation is safe and legal. One of the biggest myths that we come up against whenever we talk about food rescues, people are constantly like, oh, I thought you can't do that. I thought it's a liability. I thought it's illegal. And so that's actually the biggest challenge that we face, is kind of fixing that cultural norm. And I think it's really interesting because Bill Clinton passed the Bill Emerson Good Samaritan Act in 1996. So it's been a very long time that food rescue has been kind of protected against liability. And still we have this myth that's perpetuated that it's not legal or safe. So I think that's kind of our biggest challenge.
And so when you're, like, facing these different challenges and all these misnomers about food rescue, how do you stay motivated to keep doing the work that you're doing?
Our recipient organizations that we work with are so sweet, and they keep us going. They're constantly getting, like, both handwritten thank you notes and emails of thank yous from our recipient organizations. And I think just knowing that we are making an impact is really enough for me. Plus, our team is really great, both our food rescuers and our HQ team. Everyone really cares about the mission and is really driven. And I think it's really interesting because we have people that are more focused on the environmental reasons for doing this, and then people who are more focused on the food insecurity reasons for doing food rescue. And I think that it comes together, and there's a lot of motivation to make this work.
Yeah, that's amazing. I think it's funny that you mentioned that, like, you still haven't gotten to, like, bringing your own reusables, because I'm, like, kind of, I don't know, a little bit of a, like, Nazi about, like, making sure that, like, I have my straw and I have my spoon, and then when it doesn't happen, like, it really is tough. Like, I feel like San Francisco has a little bit more awareness around compostables being from materials that are going to biodegrade. In New York City, no one understands this. Like, you go to cafes in New York and you are ordering in, and they will still hand you your things in something that is disposable, and it just makes absolutely no sense.
Yeah, I think it's so interesting. When I went to New York recently, I think I was kind of shocked by the amount, like, the even more plastic that there was. But it's funny because I think in the Bay Area, because there's so much access to compostables, we've kind of really leaned on that. And it's funny because that anecdote that I was telling you about the ice cream and, like, asking for the metal sample spoon instead, she was like, oh, well, the spoon, it's compostable. It's not plastic. And I was like, oh, no, still trying to get away from the single-use stuff altogether, but it's difficult. And I need to start bringing my own reusable places. There's not really an excuse at this point.
It's tough, you know. It's hard to live this life where you're obviously trying to like make this business grow and be very mindful about it, and it's hard to be perfect all the time.
Yeah, definitely.
What do you think are, I guess, some of the things that people can do? Like, obviously, your company is based out on the West Coast, but I think everyone can make some efforts to help reduce their impact in whatever way possible.
Yeah.
So what would be your suggestion to someone who is maybe just kind of getting into this, maybe not sure what to do next? Like, what would be your advice to them?
So I think the first thing is educating yourself and others. One is helping kind of debunk this myth that food rescue is unsafe or illegal. So that's number one. Number two, I think just noticing in your day-to-day life how much food you're actually throwing away, because I think we have a tendency to kind of gloss over it and not really internalize it. Instead, when you're wasting something, notice what you're wasting and like think about why. Did you overbuy? Did you have plans that suddenly came up and so you didn't eat at home and you went out instead? And starting to be really honest about your behavior, because I think at home is kind of the first step towards reducing surplus food, at least on an individual level, and starting to go, okay, and what are the things that I am frequently throwing away? So whether that's kind of like keeping a little mental note or actually jotting it down in your phone or in a journal. I, for example, knew that I always buy parsley and I always buy lemons. And sometimes I let those lemons and that parsley go by the wayside. And once I noticed that that was a frequent occurrence for me, I was like, okay, so I know I'm not going to stop buying parsley because I use it very frequently, but I'm not using all the stems and I'm kind of picking off the leaves. So there's this weird amount left. So what can I do with this? And like being creative, looking up recipes and like found this green sauce that I can make with the stems and with the excess lemon. And while that's a pain in the butt to do every single time, my outlook now is like, I have to do that or I'm not going to buy this thing. So making those shifts, it's helped me in my personal life. But I think the other thing is like when you're out at restaurants, sharing. I think at restaurants, it's very easy to overorder. We get excited because we want to try all the things. So sharing meals or bringing a container so you can pack up half and dedicate, like honoring that, like if you do not finish it at the restaurant, that you are going to bring it home and you're going to actually eat it at home. And I think, you know, also just being honest with yourself about your behavior. I used to pack a lunch 5 days a week and now I only pack a lunch 4 days a week because I know that on Fridays I end up eating out with my coworkers. And sometimes that meal that I would make on Friday would just sit in the fridge and get forgotten over the weekend and sometimes would go bad or wouldn't, you know, be appealing anymore. And so going, okay, I know that I'm not going to eat lunch, whatever I prepared that day. So maybe not meal prepping for that day and knowing that I'm going to eat out.
Yeah, no, that's super interesting. I think you kind of like hit a point that I don't think a lot of people have really talked about, which is the fact that like there are certain lifestyles and lifestyle choices that work for certain people.
Yeah.
I want to ask you this because I think it's something that annoys me the most when I am trying to make the case for someone to not throw out food.
Yeah.
And the case is, well, I've already ordered it. I've already touched it. I'm not going to eat it. I'm not taking it home with me. It doesn't really matter if I throw this out.
Oh, it does matter if you throw it out. One, I think that people tend to think of food as like the okay thing to waste because it's like, oh, it's biodegradable. That's why you see people like throw banana peels like out their car window and think that it's fine. But one, recognizing like the environmental impact that that food has when it's in landfill versus in compost, because it emits 3 times more methane than it would if it was composted. So that's number one. That food, that same food going into the landfill is not the same as it going into compost. And two, just starting to recognize and value all of the labor that went into making that food. I think when we throw away food, we are being really ignorant about our food system and the amount of work and resources that went into making that food. And I think obviously it's very important that food donations are safe and that food that somebody else is going to want to eat. But taking into account when you are valuing food and like really understanding what's wasted when you're throwing that food away, because I think it's really telling to me when people are so flippant and okay with throwing food away that they don't have a very deep understanding of our food system and the amount of labor and water and emissions that have gone into making this thing.
I think those are two extremely good points to make.
Yeah, I think in those instances, it's always trying to get people to understand that, like, okay, that's fine in this instance, but, like, making sure that that behavior doesn't continue, because those people that tend to do that tend to do, it's not just this one time. It's over, like, and it's, I think, kind of getting them to recognize over the course of a lifetime, how much food are they wasting because of this behavior? Because, yeah, half a sandwich doesn't seem like a lot in this moment, but if it's half a sandwich every day for 20 years, that's a lot of food waste.
Yeah, no, for sure. I'm glad that you have a better response to that than I do when people are wasting.
It seems like inherently just like awful. So it's like very hard when you have such an emotional reaction to it, to like, oh, it just makes so much inherent sense that you wouldn't waste food. Yeah, that trying to explain it to someone can be difficult.
Thing, I think like Tristram Stewart made this point, you know, don't be embarrassed if your friend has like, he called them chips because he's British, but he's like, you know, if your friend has French fries left over, don't be embarrassed to like eat your friend's French fries.
Oh yeah, definitely. That's like common occurrence at our office to avoid wasting food.
Exactly. Yeah. I think it's, I'm like always that friend, and my friends are always like, what are you doing? And I was like, you left food. Like, I'm eating it.
Like at restaurants, making sure to order, not ordering everything that you want at once necessarily. Like, let's get through these things. And then if we're still hungry and we still want more, like, let's order this other thing. But I also, when I go out to eat, this is like a little weird, but like, thinking about, okay, if I'm going to have leftovers, what would I actually eat? For example, like the salad I need to finish because I'm not going to eat that the next day. But the pizza I'll eat tomorrow and that's fine as a leftover. But like actually taking inventory when you're eating and like thinking about it, if you know that you're going to have some sort of excess, like what would you actually take home?
Yeah. I mean, no joke. My friend did that at tea the other day because she was like, you know, the scones are not going to keep, but these cookies will be fine. So she like ate her scones and then took the cookies home.
Yeah, no, exactly. Yeah. Anytime I go out for brunch, I'm like, okay, got to finish the eggs. Like that would be gross to take home, but the potatoes, I will definitely reheat and probably make another egg to eat with it. You know, so it's just thinking about it, putting a little more thought.
Cool. Awesome. Well, anything else that you want to like advocate for, like how can people find more information about Replate, and if they want to get involved in your project, how can they find you?
So the best way to find us is at replate.org, which is our website. We also have a blog where you can learn more. We actually just had two pretty interesting articles about the water that's wasted when you waste food, or on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at Replate Your Meal.
I hope that people check it out. I hope people utilize the service, especially if you are someone like me who works in an office where there's excess food. I think it's a really super easy program that is like super easy to pitch.
Pickups are now $50 a pickup if you're not on a subscription plan. Otherwise, it's about $40 a pickup.
Okay, cool. Good to know. Awesome. Well, I do hope that people use the service and check it out and live in the West Coast area and want to work with or get involved with Replate. I'm sure people can find you on LinkedIn.
Yeah, definitely.
Cool. Awesome. Great. Well, thank you so much for taking the time, Katie.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Barbara.
I love the fact that Katie is challenging herself to recategorize food that's left over as surplus food rather than wasted food. It's such a small switch, but it's a change in attitude and beliefs that can really help make the difference in a system where 40% of food is wasted. Something else that I loved learning about is the food recovery hierarchy. Check out in the show notes for a link to this upside down pyramid. If you work in an office space or at a restaurant where there is food surplus, get signed up on Replate. It's super simple and you don't have to commit to any number of rescues. Just use the service as you need it, when you need it. Finally, if this podcast inspires you, I would really appreciate it if you took the time to subscribe, share, and rate this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you're tuning in from. Your support really does help to make a difference in what we're able to accomplish, and I love reading your positive reviews. Just like the content you purchase on Netflix or Amazon Prime, you can support the content of this show by visiting anchor.fm/trashtalking. And click on the Support This Podcast link. For as little as 99 cents a month, you can help us continue this show and spur more eco-warriors to action. Check back in a couple weeks when we'll have an interview with the founder of the Rockaway Waterfront Alliance and an announcement for their International Cleanup Day on September 14th, where I hope you'll join me and other eco-warriors to help clean up the Rockaways here in New York City. Thanks for tuning in and stay green.
Thanks for talking dirty with us. Tune in next week for more Trash Talking with Eco Warriors. For more inspiration, follow us on Instagram at @trashybeautyco.